and your peers looking around and saying, well, maybe I should be doing something like that.
All year, we've been hearing stories of people who spend time volunteering. Ahead, a look at what we've learned. For Thursday, November 27th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Ahead, the latest on the shooting of two National Guard members in Washington, D.C., and how the alleged shooter was screened before coming to the U.S.
I can tell you from personal and firsthand experience that multiple law enforcement and intelligence agencies were involved in the security process.
And today's about family and rest, but Thanksgiving also kicks off the holiday shopping season. We'll hear tips on how to navigate presents in a year of high prices.
When my kids were tiny, I would just find stuff in the house that they weren't playing with or and wrap it up and put it under the tree.
First News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Dale Willman. Federal officials in a nonprofit group say the Afghan man who was allegedly shot two National Guard members in Washington, D.C., worked with the unit linked to the CIA. The FBI says the suspect, Ramanullah Lakhanwal, is now the focus of a terrorism investigation. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
CIA officials have confirmed Lakhanwal worked with the U.S. government in Afghanistan. A nonprofit group called Afghan Evac says Lakhanwal served with an elite counterterrorism unit. FBI Director Kash Patel says that history will be a focus of their probe.
We are fully investigating that aspect of his background as well, to include any known associates that are either overseas or here in the United States of America.
Lakhanwal entered the U.S. in 2021 and was granted asylum in April of this year. Officials say the two West Virginia National Guard soldiers injured in Wednesday's attack have undergone surgery and remain in critical condition. Brian Mann, NPR News.
The shooting suspect, meanwhile, is facing multiple charges, including three counts of assault with intent to kill while armed, along with possession of a firearm during a crime of violence. But Attorney General Pam Bondi says that could change.
If something happens, I will tell you right now, I will tell you early, we will do everything in our power to seek the death penalty against that monster who should not have been in our country.
President Trump may be changing his mind about extending subsidies to help people buy health insurance. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
For months, President Trump and Republicans in Congress said the government should not extend expiring Obamacare subsidies. But now, as a promised December vote on the tax credits nears, Trump may be reversing his position. He is reportedly considering a plan to extend the subsidies for 2 years with an income cap, even though it's not clear that Republicans in Congress would go along with that. And the president himself said on Tuesday that he would rather not extend the subsidies, but, quote, some kind of extension may be necessary. More than 20 million people benefit from the Obamacare tax credits to help them afford health insurance. President Trump has tried and failed to get rid of Obamacare altogether, but the program has proved tough to uproot. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
The president of the Dominican Republic has given the U.S. authorization to operate inside restricted areas in that Caribbean country. That means the U.S. can refuel aircraft and transport equipment and people through an airport near the capital city. The announcement comes as the U.S. is increasing its military presence in the region because of tensions with Venezuela. New York's Macy's Day Thanksgiving Parade was a success today. Hundreds of thousands of people turned out for the annual event that featured dozens of balloons, floats, clown groups, and marching bands. The parade began on Manhattan's Upper West Side and ended on 34th Street. This is NPR News. Firefighters in Hong Kong are continuing their efforts to find dozens of people still unaccounted for following yesterday's massive fire in an apartment complex there. At least 75 people are now dead from the fire that burned in seven of the complex's eight apartment buildings. Dozens of others were injured. Officials say extreme heat continues to slow the rescue operations. It's Thanksgiving, and for millions of Americans, that means buying, cooking, and eating a lot of food. It also means tons of food waste, NPR's Jacqueline Diaz explains.
Thanksgiving is the biggest day for food waste in the U.S. That's according to the Natural Resources Defense Fund, an environmental advocacy group. Roughly 200 million pounds of turkey meat are thrown out every year. But food waste is a year-round problem. Ted Janicki is a professor at Penn State who studies this problem.
If food waste were its own country, then it would be the third largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world.
Those emission figures are from all stages of the food system, from farm to landfill. Food tossed into landfills piles up, breaks down, and produces methane, a greenhouse gas. But there are things we can do, including composting food and freezing leftovers. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
Golfer Fuzzy Zeller has died. The Masters and U.S. Open champion was one of golf's most gregarious characters, as well as one of its biggest boosters. But his career was also marred by a racially insensitive joke he made about Tiger Woods during the 1997 Masters. He later said that moment would never go away. Fuzzy Zeller was 74 years old. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. This weekend, After Dark, our late-night Saturday showcase of a variety of music styles, will be Mark Labundy with 3 hours of power pop nuggets.
Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow. Happy Thanksgiving. On this holiday, we are doing something a little different. We're taking some time to talk about the volunteer work Americans do. For the past 6 months, we have been featuring stories of service and community in a series called Here to Help. Stories of people like 76-year-old Gerard Vanderwerken, a volunteer with Habitat for Humanity Austin. He loves the work. He did his 50th build this year. He says his favorite part is when he and other volunteers turn over the keys to the family who will be living in their new home.
I was called a crier. Every dedication I speak and I shed tears because what most people didn't realize that I was an immigrant too. I came to America many, many years ago. I was born in Jakarta, Indonesia. So I'm basically Americanized, but to come to America at that time, there was a helping hand to get us here. And so I was very appreciative of that extending hand. So I was willing to give back. And so it just moves me to see that there are people in this world that really understands that you can't get through life without a helping hand.
Earlier this year, we also heard from Lee Cooper. Cooper volunteers at Maine Needs, a group that provides clothing for people in need, where he puts together shopping bags of clothes for people he will never meet, including some recovering from addiction.
I know what it's like in early sobriety. I've been sober for 33 years. I did the best packing job I could for her. Tried to pick the prettiest, the newest, and then I gave her a Minute for Mom kit, which is a kit we do for moms as a rule, which has fancy soap and sometimes a hairbrush. And I wrote her a note that just said, good luck in your sobriety.
And on a day all about giving thanks, we wanted to thank you, our listeners, because many of these stories came from you. We put a call out to tell us about your experiences volunteering or to nominate someone in your life who gives back. We got hundreds of responses from all across the country. You nominated volunteer librarians and scout leaders. You told us stories of volunteering in food pantries and municipal boards, even community compost groups. Here are just a few examples of those. James and Hillary Cornwell are a married couple who have volunteered as medieval reenactors in middle school classrooms for 35 years. Don't worry, they've got armor.
We bring real metal and leather pieces of armor for kids to try on. And while they're replicas, the pieces have been built to the same standards of durability that the real ones were made for centuries ago. My wife and I got into this line of volunteer work when we had just gotten together as a couple in the early 1990s. We were in our 20s when we started visiting middle school classrooms. Now all of us are old enough to be the seventh graders' grandparents. Well, there's a sense of fulfillment in volunteering in classrooms and in keeping connected with kids now that our own children are grown. Some of the motivation is selfish. The students keep us sharp.
Jake Sale is a professional usher at San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House. He called us to nominate the people who volunteer to work with him during performances.
There's a quiet dignity in what they do. Greeting first-time opera-goers with a smile, guiding lost audience members through ornate hallways, standing for hours just to make sure somebody else has a beautiful night. Working alongside them has changed the way I think about service. It's not always about grand gestures. It's small acts of steadiness.
Alan Smith Hicks nominated his mother, Sandra Hicks, from Manchester, New Hampshire, who passed away in 2020.
She was the hardest working retired person I've ever known. In the 1970s, she was legally blind, but for almost 50 years, she dedicated her life to volunteerism, activism, advocacy, community education, and social justice.
Thanksgiving week is one of the biggest times for volunteering across the country. So we wanted to check out one of those efforts close to us in the Washington area.
For Cheddar Cheese, line A will be the Girl Scouts. And line B for Cheddar Cheese will be the Jack and Jill National Harbor.
This past Saturday, hundreds of volunteers from local high schools, colleges, and historically black Greek letter organizations packed the Student Center at the University of the District of Columbia. They had a pretty straightforward goal, to feed as many people as possible. Everyone was clamoring to speak with Ransom Miller, who was making sure there weren't any gaps in assembly line action.
I want one person on each side and then y'all rotate. Is that good?
Miller is the founder and chair of the nonprofit Project Give Back. It holds one of the largest annual Thanksgiving food distributions in the Mid-Atlantic region. Meadie Bardinelli has been volunteering with Project Give Back for more than 20 years and remembers back when things were a little bit slimmer on the volunteer side. She said she's especially glad to see people getting involved this year when the government shutdown paused SNAP benefits for so many people, and when federal workers in the region went more than a month without a paycheck.
So I believe that this year's Project Give Back continues, not just this year, continues to show the importance of food insecurity. It's imperative that Maslow's hierarchy of needs starts off with food, clothing, and shelter. And so if we don't have food to sustain us, then it's a no-go. It's a non-starter, right?
Jameer Ferrier, a college student at the Naval Academy, said he had everything he could have ever wanted growing up, so it's important for him to take the opportunity to help people who are less fortunate. He carried a box full of food that will help one of thousands of families.
Chicken, stuffing, elbow noodles, cheese, flounder, carrots. I grabbed some pork or something of that nature.
He was taking direction from project leader Ransom Miller. Miller recently stopped by NPR studio to talk about the origins of Project Give Back. He recalled how the initial idea took shape as he was talking to a few coworkers.
Actually, we were in a lunchroom, you know, lamenting over how blessed we were and how fortunate we were as young professionals.
This was at your place of work?
Yeah, so this was at TCBA, which is a local accounting firm.
Mm-hmm.
And just a lunchroom conversation that really people jumped into and shared how blessed they felt. You know, there was a homeless population downtown D.C. at that time, and we had just come in, talked to a couple of people who were going through some hard times. And that conversation turned into, hey, why don't we do something for somebody else this Thanksgiving?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everybody was supportive of it. And that year we helped six families for Thanksgiving. Initially, that was a great thing to do.
Yeah.
But it was no big vision of what we have now.
Just a few people at work.
Yeah.
Kind of on the fly.
Yeah.
Helping a handful of families.
Yeah. And I think what happened was those same people came back the next year and said, hey, what are we doing this year? And I was like, well, I don't know. What do you mean? Oh, you know, the project where we gave back to the community and we gave food baskets. I was like, well,
Let's
do it again. And he said, well, what are you calling this thing? And he had just said those words together. So I said, well, we're going to call it Project Give Back.
Help people understand just how big we're talking here. Like, what's the best way to understand the scope of this in 2025?
Well, I think maybe close to 1,000 volunteers getting up, some at 5 in the morning, to pack boxes for somebody else. I think that's a big way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are a volunteer organization. Nobody gets paid. We don't have any paid staff. All of the money that we raise goes into our programming. But we've assembled a team of people who have made that a seamless process.
How many people do you get food to each year?
Last year was 5,000.
Okay.
This year, actually, it's a funny story. My 11-year-old son, Harrison, asked me, how many families are we helping this year? And I said, about 5,000. So he said, okay. He said, well, how many did we do last year? I said, about 5,000. He said, well, don't you think we should do more? And I was like, what do you mean? You know, and immediately I started thinking, well, that's more money to raise. That's more coordination.
Yeah.
And I started thinking about it. And then I just heard his voice. And he was very confident. He's like, well, I think we should do more.
Well, I'm wondering if maybe the increased focus on the safety net that we've seen across the country and here in D.C., thousands of federal workers went more than a month without a paycheck. We saw a disruption in SNAP benefits. There's a real focus on food assistance in the way that I don't think we've seen in a long time. How have you seen that from your point of view?
I think doing this type of work, we see every year how hard it is for certain families. I'm talking about two-parent households working, having trouble making ends meet. It's troubling to a lot of people, but it's not a surprise because we know that there's definitely a need in this area and probably across the country, but there's a need in this area for food assistance.
Mm-hmm.
But this problem, the SNAP benefits and the federal government shutdown, exacerbated that problem. We have never gotten the amount of calls that we got this year. But I think there's something called positive peer pressure. If you're doing something that's good and your peer is looking around and saying, well, maybe I should be doing something like that. And that's what we hope to do. I think that's one of the reasons we've been able to expand. So we're doing this on what we call Give Back Saturday. And we're doing this in Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. But we're also doing it in Oklahoma City, which is my hometown. We're also doing it in Indianapolis, Indiana.
You're franchising it.
Basically. Basically. And what better to franchise than service and helping other people?
That's Ransom Miller, the founder and chair of the nonprofit Project Give Back, which has held a Thanksgiving food distribution for more than 30 years now. Thank you so much for coming in.
Yes.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
As you just heard, the first year that Ransom Miller did Project Give Back, it fed six families. This year, it provided food for more than 5,700 families. You can hear more stories focused on service, community, and giving back year-round at npr.org/here to help. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is your daily dose of phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. Programming on KAXE KBXE is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, proud to partner with the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation to celebrate the honorees of the 2025 Bush Prize Minnesota, Foster Advocates, and Dakota Wekohan. More information online at spmfc.org.
On today's date, November 27th, 1999, a pair of brown creepers visits my feeder area. They don't come to the feeder. They're not seed-eating birds. I've got suet out, and they don't come to the suet. Their intent is to glean any insect that they can find from among the crevices of the bark of the Norway pines in my yard. And they do a fabulous job. As if well designed by nature, they have this long decurved beak which allows them to probe crevices and crannies and find any little morsel that might be edible down in there. And oddly enough, they seem to be in partnership with the nuthatches, because the nuthatches will work the tree from top to bottom, giving them one look at the things that may be hiding in the bark. And the creepers work the tree from bottom to top, so they are looking at the other side of the bark in its crevices and crannies. It's an interesting relationship, but one that must be awfully tough if you're a spider or a small worm trying to hide out the winter in the bark of the Norway pine.
for NPR comes from this station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And from The Economist. In a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise, to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, and videos at economist.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Today's Thanksgiving, and we're going to take a few moments to be thankful for everything we have. But tomorrow on Black Friday, we are going to be asked to buy a whole bunch of stuff. The holiday season can be expensive. There's travel, there's gifts, and that's all on top of everyday financial pressures. So how do we navigate all of this? That is the kind of question that Michelle Singletary is asked all the time by her readers. She is a personal finance expert and writes The Color of Money, a nationally syndicated column from The Washington Post. She's here to impart some of that wisdom onto us as part of our cost of living series, The Price We Pay. Good to talk to you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
So let's look forward to tomorrow, Black Friday. It's changed a lot over the years, right? It's been extended. It's become as much of a digital thing as an in-person thing. Is it worth getting out there and throwing elbows and going to the mall and the stores tomorrow? Or should we just stay home? Like, what? How do you start there?
I say stay home, eat some more pie, talk to your family members. But I actually stay away. I like to just chill.
I appreciate that advice. What concerns are you hearing from readers? What questions are you hearing from readers right now at, like I said, an expensive time of year, in a year where everything is more expensive?
Yeah. I think this year the magic word is affordability.
Yeah.
And so many people are feeling the pressure of things being more expensive, job insecurity. But, you know, I think the key is, and you talked about this, what can you afford? And it has to start there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, believe it or not, people always think I'm just this really cheap columnist, but I actually am very generous. But I give out of my abundance. I give out of my abundance. And I think that's the key. When we talk about the two A's this year, affordability and abundance,
yeah.
If you only have $50, that's all you have.
I want to ask about kids, though, because a lot of people have kids who live in a world of commercials, live in a world of their friends having gifts and talking about gifts. And it can be an uncomfortable conversation, an embarrassing conversation to talk to your kids and say, hey, look, we're going to have fewer presents this year.
Yeah.
What are some ways you navigate that or tell people to think about that?
Well, I always think about when, you know, my husband was starting out and we had small kids and we had a budget and we managed their expectations. We were really big on that. We would tell all three of our children, okay, give me your Christmas list. And they'd bring in this 10-page dossier. They understand better than you think what's going on in your household. They can feel it. They can feel the tension. And so you just very lovingly, age appropriate, say, it's a tough year. We're a little worried about some things. We want you to have a nice holiday. We're going to do X.
Mm-hmm.
One of the strategies, if you really, it just can't happen, you just don't have a lot, open the presents with all your family at the same time. And that way, if they're getting something from grandma or auntie and you, instead of maybe one gift, now they've gotten three in their little pile. And that's just a way to make them feel extra love while everybody's around. But when my kids were tiny people, when they don't remember anything, I would just find stuff in the house that they weren't playing with, or, you know, and wrap it up and put it under the tree. They didn't know the difference.
Man, I got so many presents this year.
I know some people thinking, that's dishonest. Well, what are they going to do? They're two. They don't know what a nursing home is just yet, so...
You've mentioned budgeting a few times. It's probably too late to have a broader conversation about budgeting this holiday season, but going forward, What is the right time of year to start thinking about, okay, what is my holiday budget? How do I start planning for that?
Well, you know, it's never too late. If you haven't gone and done all your shopping, it's still not too late to budget. What we tend to do is every year we add people to the list. They gave me something, so next year you're thinking, oh, I got to get them something. And so you have to look at what you can afford and then shoehorn in the people that you are going to buy for. And the ones that don't make the cut, they don't know they don't have to make the cut. But you send out notes and you call people and say, hey, you know, it's a hard year this year. I'm a little worried about job security. So we're going to not really do a lot of shopping this year. I hope you're okay with that. How about we just spend some time with each other? And if someone can't appreciate that, well, they don't need a gift anyway. In the end, a lot of other people will be relieved because if you move them from your list, then they can take you off of
honestly,
their list.
That's a gift in itself.
That's exactly right.
That is Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist at The Washington Post. Happy Thanksgiving. Happy holidays. Good luck navigating all these fun, tricky shopping dynamics.
Thank you.
It's time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Drolia Rothweil. In 2007, Rothweil was going through a divorce. The process was overwhelming, and most of her paycheck was going to lawyer fees. One especially hard week, with the bank account empty, she asked a friend at work if she could borrow $20 to make it to payday.
Fast forward to the next morning, and on my desk is a little note with $200 in it. And all it said was, you can't pay it back, but you can pay it forward. And that touched me so deeply because at the time, that was a lot of money for them. And for them to do that was just amazing. So it not only got me through to payday, but it just touched me so deeply. I got through that divorce. Fast forward a few years, a couple friends of mine were going through some employment struggles. It was winter time. They were saying that they weren't even sure how they were going to pay their heating bills, much less get each other a Christmas present. And so, remembering my coworker's note, I went and I got $200 and I made a photocopy of his note, which I still have. And I slipped it in an envelope. And the next time I was over there to visit, I handed that to them. And I said, open this after I leave. Because I knew that I would get emotional. And the next time I saw them, I got a big hug. And I knew the feeling they were feeling. That just relief of knowing that you've got at least a Band-Aid. So now, happily, I am in my second marriage with a lovely man. And I feel like my friend Steve Green, who I worked with and who was so gracious, was a crucial stepping stone for me finding the life I have now.
Jolina Rothweil lives in St. Louis, Missouri. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
This is NPR News.
The Federal Reserve is getting ready to vote on interest rates in a few weeks. We hear from the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. He's among the few with a say on interest rates, and we ask him where he thinks the economy is headed.
On the labor market side, I see still pretty steady. Our problem is bigger when it comes to inflation.
That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses, including cloud solutions, cybersecurity services, network management, and more, all with local customer service and support. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. Listen to the Season Watch Pod with host Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. Season Watch Pod, for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. New episodes come out on Thursdays. Great River Rescue in Bemidji is looking for donations for their upcoming online auction, which begins December 8th. Items like art, themed baskets, or gift cards may be dropped off Saturday, November 29th from 11 to 4. Now it's time for National Native News here on KAXE KBXE.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Thanksgiving is a holiday that often gives Native people mixed feelings. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire shares a few perspectives from across Indian country.
On one hand, the romanticized depiction of pilgrims and Indians happily feasting together in 1621 sidesteps the wars, disease, displacement, and oppression that came in the centuries afterwards. Some Native people boycott Thanksgiving, and the United American Indians of New England will hold their annual Day of Mourning this year, a protest held in Plymouth, Massachusetts since 1970. On the other hand, Native people love to eat with friends and family. What is one to do? Anne Marie Dakota is the Indigenous Curriculum and Instruction Specialist for Bismarck Public Schools. A member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, Dakota helps educators teach about Thanksgiving from a more authentic Native perspective. And her family reframes holidays like Thanksgiving and the 4th of July to be more relevant to them.
So instead of celebrating the holidays, they celebrate still being here, the survival, the ancestor histories. They acknowledge what happened to us. That's one thing that I would like to push, that we're still here and that's why we still celebrate, to keep our language, stories, and culture alive.
And that Thanksgiving turkey might be pushed aside to make room for fry bread, Indian tacos, and Dakota's personal favorite, wild rice casserole. Someone else who's given the holiday a lot of thought is Nancy Kelsey, an Anishinaabe of the Little River Band of Ottawa Indians and a columnist for Cleveland's Plain Dealer newspaper. She thinks it's important Native people reflect on the holiday and make it their own.
Given all of the centuries of labor on our ancestors' part for us to be here as thriving people, there is no wrong way to celebrate Thanksgiving. We can make the holiday into something that is special for us.
Kelsey says allies, including teachers, can learn about the tribes native to the lands they stand on, lift up and celebrate Indigenous storytellers, and speak up when racist and ignorant things happen. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The Gila River Indian community has long relied on convenience stores to feed its 13,000 residents, who otherwise may have to drive as far as half an hour away to neighboring cities with grocery stores. But as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, a new market, a decade in the making, has opened much closer to home.
This isn't a Bash's, it's not a Safeway or a Walmart.
Duncan Winston with Gila River Development says the tribe's new 14,000 square foot supermarket in the heart of Sacaton is much more than a store. It's a symbol of their sovereignty, since few, if any, tribes outright own their own grocers.
We don't want to leave that in the hands of a larger chain to determine who gets what. We want to be able to fight for ourselves and bring the necessary goods to our community when we need them.
From fresh produce and butchered meats to a deli serving local favorites, like the Works Burger.
One of the biggest demands from the community was you got to bring the Works back, and so we've done that.
But that doesn't come cheap because of what some refer to as resflation.
We have experienced it here. I mean, it's difficult finding reputable vendors who are willing to bring us goods and services at a fair price. Although we are rural, we are a lot closer to the metropolitan Phoenix area than a lot of the other tribes in Arizona.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Need an actionable plan to achieve your goals? Kaufman & Associates strengthens Native organizations through culturally grounded strategic planning. More at kaufmaninc.com. KAUFFMANINC.com.
Skugtash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Yeh.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Come. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. The man who allegedly shot two National Guard members in Washington on Wednesday is in custody. A 29-year-old Afghan man, Rahmanullah Lakhanwal, has been identified by authorities as the alleged shooter. According to law enforcement, he drove across the country from Washington State to carry out the shootings. Lakhanwal previously served in one of Afghanistan's elite counterterrorism units operated by the CIA. After the fall of Kabul in August 2021, Lakhanwal came to the U.S. in a Biden-era evacuation effort called Operation Allies Welcome, which processed tens of thousands of applications by Afghan evacuees. Lakhanwal was granted asylum under the Trump administration earlier this year. Now, in response to the shooting, the Trump White House announced an immediate pause on immigration applications filed by Afghan nationals. The president said that all Afghan immigration that was processed during the Biden administration should be reexamined. Haris Tareen is the vice president of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, and he served as the chief of staff for Operation Allies Welcome. He joins us now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
I want to start with your reaction to two aspects of this news. First, what you've been thinking and feeling since you learned that this alleged shooter is somebody who came to the U.S. through Operation Allies Welcome.
Well, first, our hearts go out to the two members of the National Guard and their families. And this tragedy struck the heart of our nation's capital when I found out that this individual was an Afghan national. My parents came to this country from Afghanistan in the 1980s. And so to feel that someone who shares an identity, who would do something this tragic, really was immense amount of pain.
Yeah.
For me, it really struck personally and deeply.
President Trump quickly tied this to the way that this individual came into this country and, as we noted, has decided to pause all Afghan immigration applications. What's your response to that?
This individual came to the U.S. under the Biden administration, but his asylum application was approved in the Trump administration. So that means he went through multiple layers of security and security checks.
Can you, since this is going to be in the news so much in the coming days, from your vantage point, from your understanding, can you explain kind of what those levels of security check look like?
Well, there's multiple levels. The fact that he worked with an intelligence agency, they would, of course, do a very thorough check in Afghanistan because he was working with them. That would include, of course, background checks. That would include mental health screenings and lie detectors and so many different aspects when you work with parts of the intelligence communities. So there's multiple layers that this individual has gone through.
I want to talk about Operation Allies Welcome, though, because it's being scrutinized again. And there really was, from many different angles, widespread criticism of this effort, that it was chaotic, poorly organized, that many people were left behind. And, you know, then there were more recent Department of Justice reports, among other things, saying that the vetting was not up to the usual protocol. How much of that, in your perspective, is fair?
Operation Allies Welcome was being created as this tragedy of the fall of Kabul. While that was happening, this operation was being set up. Mm-hmm. So there's fair criticism to say we left people who were legitimately needed to come to this country behind. But when it comes to the security component of this, I can tell you from personal and firsthand experience that multiple law enforcement and intelligence agencies were involved in the security process. That was the FBI, the CIA, the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security. So there's fair criticism, but to completely undermine the whole operation. You know, these are individuals, Scott, who served alongside our service members. They risked their lives. And so we have to be fair in how we critique the operation and make sure that we're not blanketly blaming all Afghans who deserve a place where they can be safe and have security.
Given your confidence in the vetting and security part of this, what is your response to President Trump saying he wants to re-examine the security vetting for people who were let into the country? Do you find that to be productive in any way at all?
It's fair to continue to have scrutiny and security checks. A blanket denial of immigration status would be counterproductive because we would be leaving 200,000 or more individuals in limbo.
Can you just clarify that that number is that people already in the U.S.?
Close to about 200,000 people are already in the U.S.
Got it. What do you think the most productive way forward is in this moment? What would you like to see happen in the coming weeks?
What I'd like for us to do is to ignore the bigotry, the hate, and those individuals on X and on social media who will try to manipulate this tragedy and make it about immigrants and make it about Afghan Americans, American Muslims, and others who have served this country and dedicated their lives to this country. And so I would want us to make sure that we're empowering our professionals in the law enforcement and intelligence agencies and not the bigots who are trying to take advantage of this moment.
That's Haris Tareen, Vice President of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanksgiving is, of course, a very American holiday. So what do you do when you're an American overseas? How do you track down a turkey? NPR's Charles Maines knows a guy who can help you out in the capital of Russia.
At a central Moscow market, towards the back, past the vegetable stalls, beef butchers, caviar traders, and fishmongers, Oman Gusenu looks at me and smiles. This native of Azerbaijan knows what happens next. I will ask for one of his turkeys, and he will charge me too much for it, as he has for the past several years. It was probably a good price you paid because you didn't pay more, says Gusenu. Besides, what a bird. Everyone came out ahead. Gusenu got into the turkey business, well, because he noticed foreigners, for some reason all Americans, desperate for turkeys, not chickens, towards late November, for Thanksgiving. Sometime, a while ago, they had a military victory over the native Indians, right? So they decided to celebrate with the turkey, says Gusenu, explaining the holiday. As I shake my head no, he adds, well, the point is, it's an American holiday where they need turkeys, and they want big ones, not small ones. That's true, for a lot of people anyway. And we move to inspect the birds. 10, 12, 15-pound Russian turkeys, fresh from Stavropol, in Russia's south. And to prove it, he pulled out his phone and shows me a video. The moment these turkeys went from happily wandering the Russian fields to having their throats slit. To change the topic, I tell him I'd heard that the Southern Caucasus, where he's from, are famous for haggling. It's the market. Of course you have to negotiate, says Gusenu. So I drop a lower offer. Gusenu smiles and agrees instantly. It's a holiday, he says. I don't want you thinking about how much you spent. The implication, I could have gotten a better deal. To change the topic again, and, well, because I'm a reporter, why not, I ask him what he makes of Trump's new peace plan for Ukraine, the one everyone's talking about. I don't talk politics, he says. Turkeys and chickens, I can talk about all day. Not a bad policy for the Thanksgiving table. And then Gusenu pulled out a blowtorch and began running it over the turkey, my turkey. It's so there's no hair on it, he explained. As the butane flame spilled over the bird and its skin started to bubble, I quickly pulled out my wallet and paid up. If not this deal, then at least my turkey was on its way to well done. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to defend KAXE from funding cuts. You may receive tax benefits as well. Call Sarah for details at 218-326-1234. United Way of Northeastern Minnesota invites high school seniors to write an essay on the biggest need you see in your community and your ideas to address that need. Open to those in Coochiching and Lake of the Woods County, plus the entire Iron Range. Find more at UnitedWayNEMN.org. The deadline is January 1st. The Northern Lakes chapter of the Minnesota Dark House and Angling Association has their annual fish decoy and sporting show Saturday, November 29th from 9 to 4 at Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids. Explore spearing and ice fishing equipment, a silent auction, and more. Now for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's broadcast, several Minnesota counties are assisting federal immigration enforcement efforts. Then, as families gather to give thanks, we uncover some little-known facts about our state's turkey industry and information about a new tree disease impacting the state. I'm Gracie Jay. Eight Minnesota counties have signed agreements with Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to help identify and remove people who may be subject to deportation. According to the ICE website, the sheriff's offices in Cass, Crow Wing, Freeborn, Itasca, Jackson, Candy Ojai, Mille Lacs, and Sherburne counties are now partnering with ICE. The program allows certain federal immigration officer duties to be delegated to local law enforcement under ICE oversight. The agreements come as ICE ramps up enforcement efforts nationwide and here in Minnesota. Next, from family farms to presidential pardons, Zan Holston looks at some ways Minnesota tops the turkey industry's pecking order.
Most Minnesota turkeys go from farm to freezer to food on the table. But for the last 15 years, five sets of Minnesota toms, that's what adult male turkeys are called, have had their lives spared.
Based on your temperament and commitment to being productive members of society, I hereby pardon Peach and Blossom.
In 2024, President Biden pardoned Minnesota birds Peach and Blossom. The year before, it was Liberty and Belle. In fact, over the past 15 years, five sets of the pardoned birds were raised in Minnesota. A year on, and Blossom and Peach are living the good life at Farm America in Waseca, where program coordinator Carrie Wadd looks after them.
They're in a beautiful coop in our 1930s farmyard during the warm season months.
They go for daily walks, they get student visitors, and they've got a swank little home.
It's a glorified, I would say, like an ice fishing house. Fully finished, windows, door, has a little ramp that they have to go in and out.
It's not surprising that Minnesota has so many birds pardoned. It's the United States' largest turkey producer. According to data from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the state produces nearly 40 million birds a year from about 700 turkey farms. One of those is Erica Sawatsky's Oakdale Farm in Alexandria. As a fifth-generation turkey farmer, she, her husband, and their 6 and 2-year-old daughters raise about 120,000 birds a year.
My great-great-grandmother is the one that started the turkeys on our farm.
Back then, turkeys were just a way to make supplemental income to their traditional farm. But as time went on,
each generation, you know, after her has continued on with the turkeys and expanded in their own way and kind of followed the industry.
A couple of years ago, they switched from breeding eggs to sell to hatcheries to growing turkeys for meat. And just recently, Sawatsky said she shipped out a whole flock of birds, fresh, not frozen, to grace tables.
17,000 people on Thanksgiving will be eating turkey that was raised on our farm.
For now, Sawatsky hasn't had a bird pardoned. That's an honor reserved for the National Turkey Federation's chairperson, who changes each year. But
that is absolutely a goal of mine, to be able to do that one day.
Sawatsky is also close friends with John Zimmerman, the 2024 Turkey Federation chair who raised Peach and Blossom. He invited her family to Washington for the pardon, giving her a glimpse of the moment she hopes her own birds will experience someday.
To go on that trip last year, that was our first, actual family vacation, and my daughters, it was their first time flying.
Running a family farm means they don't get to spread their wings very often.
But we just felt like it was so cool that their first, trip on an airplane included turkeys.
Minnesota won't be getting a turkey pardon three-peat this year. The National Turkey Federation's chair is North Carolina-based Butterball CEO Jay Jandrain. But there's always next year. For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
You are listening to North Star Stories. University of Minnesota researchers have identified the pathogen that causes sudden oak death in the state for the first time. The disease has devastated West Coast forests for decades and continues to spread east with no cure available. Early detection is considered the best tool to slow its advance. Researchers detected the pathogen this summer in a sample from a plant at a Hennepin County nursery. State and university scientists will continue statewide monitoring at nurseries and Christmas tree farms.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. It is time now for our science news roundup from Shortwave, NPR Science Podcast, and I am joined, as always, by the show's two hosts, Regina
Woo!
Barber. And Emily Kwong.
I'm so sorry.
Hey, Scott.
Hi.
I'm going to guess you have brought three different science stories to talk about this week. Am I right?
Yes. The discovery that our human ancestors probably made out with Neanderthals.
Okay.
Yeah. And why scientists sent moss spores to space. And a planetary whodunit about the object that made the moon.
We all know that I'm into moon content.
Yes.
So
yes.
I appreciate that. But let's start with the making out.
Yeah. Under some prehistoric mistletoe.
How did science address this question? Like, I don't even know where to start with that.
Yeah, so many animals kiss. So birds, fish, insects, especially primates. And by kissing, scientists define that as non-aggressive, mouth-to-mouth contact that does not involve passing food.
That's gross. An important aspect.
And Matilda Brindle at the University of Oxford wanted to know, how far back in evolutionary history does this go?
If you think about the fact that humans and our closest living relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos, all kiss, it makes sense that the common ancestor of those three species kisses as well.
So tracking back through evolutionary time, Matilda's team found that kissing was present in the ancestor of all large apes 21 million years ago. And they published these results in the journal Evolution and Human Behavior.
How do you even begin to see if somebody was kissing somebody 21 million years ago?
Yeah.
Like, was there a fossilized mid-kiss? I don't know.
That would be really cool,
yeah.
But no.
Oh.
This was all done through what's called phylogenetic analysis. Matilda and her colleagues basically treated kissing as a trait and mapped it onto like a tree of primates.
Which they did by determining which primates kiss and which do not. So Matilda had to watch a lot of video footage of primates locking lips, and she compiled evidence of which of our primate cousins canoodle. She built her family tree, and she discovered something else, which is that Neanderthals probably kissed too, and that is a big deal.
Why does that matter?
Well, most humans of non-African descent have a very small amount of Neanderthal DNA.
Okay.
And we know that Neanderthals and humans interbred after the two species split. And this kissing study gives us a little bit more insight into those relationships.
Humans and Neanderthals were probably kissing each other, which is a way more romantic take on human-Neanderthal relationships than I think we might have thought of before.
What a romantic image.
I know.
Equally romantic in my mind is moss spores in space.
Ooh. Right, yeah.
How did this experiment come about?
So, as humans contemplate long-term space travel, scientists want to know which plants may survive the extremes of space, because space is cold. There is a lot of radiation. It's a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists can simulate some of that on Earth. But to know how a plant will do in space, you got to put it there.
And I assume that if you're going on really long space travel at some point, you'd probably want some plants with you.
Yeah, you want them for things like oxygen production, maybe to help terraform a planet once that becomes possible. And for many people, aesthetics.
Right, right. That's true. But why moss in particular?
Well, because moss has some like incredible survival strategies. Bryophytes, the group of plants that includes mosses, were the first plants to move from water to land.
We believe moss colonized on land about 500 million years ago, so they can survive for a long such period. Even dinosaurs may be extinct, but still moss can survive.
This is plant biologist Tomomichi Fujita at Hokkaido University, who led the work. And he says land is a lot harsher than the ocean, with larger temperature fluctuations, higher risk of drying out, and more UV.
In ground studies before the team sent moss to space, they found that moss spores, which were enclosed in this protective coating called a sporangium, did much better with exposure to extreme heat and cold, and importantly, to UV.
So the moss spores passed the UV test on Earth. How do they do in space?
They did shockingly well, says Magdalena Bezania, a cell biologist at Dartmouth who is not involved in this work. Her lab just happens to study the same moss.
I was really surprised. I mean, the spores just went out. They were just phenomenal.
After 9 months in space, more than 80% of these spores germinated once they were back on Earth. From this, scientists calculate the spores could go about 15 years in space conditions and still germinate. The team published their results in the journal iScience.
So we're gonna terraform with them?
Well, the paper points out that moss and other bryophytes can survive low light. They're great at making oxygen and fixing carbon, and they could be good at transforming other planets' surfaces into fertile soil.
But the scientists have only shown that the spores can survive, you know? They haven't shown that the moss, the green fuzzy stuff that you see on Earth, can grow in space under this extreme radiation.
Finally, we're going to talk about a moon. This week, it's our moon, close-to-home moon.
Yes.
Gina, I'm always pro-moon stories. Tell me about this week's.
Yes, Scott. Okay, right now, in the sky, there's a moon.
True.
Okay. And then in the beginning, when the solar system was forming, there was a proto-Earth and no moon.
No moon.
Then something maybe the size of Mars came and smashed into proto-Earth, and that debris from that giant crash made the moon. And the name of this, like, planet-smashing object was Theia.
Now, a new paper in the journal Science is attempting to figure out what this object Theia was made out of and where in the solar system it came from. Here's how Kelsey Preisel put it. She's a geochemist from Purdue University who didn't work on this study.
For me, this paper reads kind of like a planetary whodunit, where we're trying to figure out how do we form the Earth-Moon system.
All right, so where did Theia, the Earth Smasher,
yeah,
it's like a mythological phrase,
yeah, it's like a Marvel villain.
Yeah.
Well, they looked at lunar samples brought back from NASA's Apollo missions and other meteorites from our solar system, and comparing those samples to rock samples from Earth, they found that Theia, the Earth Smasher, could have been born even closer to the sun than Earth. So Theia was born in the inner solar system.
Scott, the call is coming from inside the house, okay? And this also gives us a clue about maybe the origins of water on Earth.
Water, how so?
If Theia had formed in the outer solar system, so past Jupiter where it's colder, there's ice, some scientists thought that Theia could have delivered water to Earth during that collision. But with this study, we now know that Theia came from the inner solar system, which is drier, mm-hmm. and that means that Theia was probably not the source of water on Earth.
But now I'm curious, where did Earth's water come from?
So I asked that to the lead author of the study. His name is Timo Hopp, and he's from the Max Planck Institute in Germany.
Theia could not have brought a lot of water to the Earth. That means the water must have come from another type of material or process later or earlier, likely earlier.
Now, water could have come from comets. It could have formed when the Earth did. Though to truly solve the debate, we're just going to need to gather more space rocks. Because if Theia did indeed come from closer to the sun, we would need samples from Venus or Mercury to prove it.
But sadly, technology to withstand like the harsh surfaces of Mercury and Venus and actually travel there efficiently and back, our technology is just not totally there.
That's Regina Barber and Emily Kwong from NPR Science Podcast Shortwave. You can subscribe now for new discoveries, everyday mysteries, and the science behind the headlines. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, a story of love and loss that inspired the creation of Shakespeare's Hamlet, directed by Chloe Zhao, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. This is NPR.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at kaxe.org. We receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Essentia Health Fauston has its 21st annual Tree Walk for Hospice, Sunday, November 30th, at Miguelson Elementary School. The Fauston Langby Lions Club has a pancake breakfast from 10 to noon, with a remembrance program and candle lighting ceremony at 12:15. Attendees can stroll through decorated Christmas trees and bid in a silent auction. The Bemidji Senior Center invites you to a Christmas concert with the First City Singers Monday, December 1st at 4 p.m.
You can't paint with a broad brush this entire community, right?